We all deserve some yay in our day. So say hello to Hello. Hello makes oral and personal care products that add wonder to your routine, like a toothpaste that makes brushing fun for kids. It's called Unicorn Sparkle Toothpaste. It tastes like rainbows and sunshine, works brilliantly, and it's fun. So it's pretty much magic. And for the adults, Hello Anti-Plaque and Whitening Toothpaste, which is just as good without the unicorns. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids.
But with Anabay, you never have to stress about messes again. At washablesofas.com, discover Anabay sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, that means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly, perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply. There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At washablesofas.com, you'll find the Anabay sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabay has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Richard Merritt from the Hidden Killers podcast on the True Crime Today Network.
All right. Good morning. We were waiting for the last couple of jurors, but I did want to put something on the record this morning before we get started. I emailed you all yesterday evening about one of the jurors who sent a message to my office after we sent the notification that he had been selected, and I believe it's juror number 36. Yeah, juror number 36. And this was an email that he sent at 6:17 p.m. that says, "Hi, Twee," that's my judicial assistant, "as I stated in today in court, my wife is having serious pregnancy complications, and it is going to be incredibly hard for me to pull this off. I'm happy to provide a doctor's note regarding my wife's condition, but I'm currently the sole carer of our 2-year-old son. Please let me know my options from here as soon as possible." So that was the initial email that we received that I sent to you. And then later, yesterday evening at 7:24, he sent another email that says, "Hi, Twee, I've just made other arrangements for my wife and I'm good to go, so don't even worry about it. Thanks for the quick response. We'll be there 9 a.m. tomorrow morning." And he's here. So my suggestion is that we just sort of leave it alone and not address it at this point. I'm sure he'll let us know if there are any other issues. So is there anything else we need to put on the record or address in regards to that?
Yes, we just had a minor scheduling issue this morning. We had to move the travel arrangements for the medical examiner is coming from Little Rock, Arkansas, a couple of times this week due to the trial being pushed back a couple of days. Therefore, we were only able to get her off standby flight this morning. Well, she was bumped this morning at 5 a.m. The new plan is to fly her in and have her here. She can be here by 9, we believe, on Tuesday morning, and she would just be the last witness that we call. So although I had anticipated that we put all the witnesses up today, tomorrow, we are having that kind of a snafu this morning.
Okay. So she should be here and be prepared to testify on Tuesday.
Tuesday morning, yes.
Okay.
I think her flight gets in at 8, so we will be rushing her from the airport to court.
Okay. All right. Anything further before we bring the jury out?
Not from the state, but may I set up?
Yes. Mr. Queen, anything further before we bring the jury out?
Very much.
So there's no surprise. I did give Your Honor a list of witnesses we plan on calling. That's going to be a little bit out of order. And there is one witness who is on the original witness list that we are calling instead of one of those witnesses. Officer Ashley Nelson, as opposed to Sergeant Investor.
Okay. Hope you all had a nice evening. Before we begin with the evidence in the case, I am going to give you some preliminary instructions just to give you an overview of the trial procedure and what you can expect during the course of the trial. This will take me about 10 or 15 minutes to read to you, and then we'll begin with the opening statements from the attorneys. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been sworn and impaneled, and you are about to try a criminal case entitled The State of Georgia versus Richard Vincent Merritt. The defendant, Mr. Merritt, has been indicted by the grand jury of DeKalb County in an indictment that I read to you yesterday. To this indictment that I read to you, the defendant has pled not guilty and denies each and every allegation therein. This is what forms the issue that you have been selected, sworn, and impaneled to try. Before we begin the trial, I am going to give you some preliminary instructions on fundamental principles of criminal law. I will also instruct you on the role of the judge, the jury, and the lawyers, and give you an overview of the trial procedure. Many of you may have never served on a jury before, and it is therefore necessary that these instructions be given so that you have a general understanding of the procedure in a criminal trial, what will be expected of you, and how you are to conduct yourself during the trial. The defendant is charged in the indictment with crimes that are violations of certain laws of the state of Georgia. I want to emphasize to you that the indictment, including all of the counts therein, and the plea of not guilty are the legal procedures by which the criminal charges are brought against the defendant. The charges and plea of not guilty are not evidence of guilt and should not be considered by you as evidence or implication of guilt of any crime whatsoever. This defendant is presumed to be innocent until he is proven guilty. The defendant enters upon the trial of the case with a presumption of innocence in his favor, and that presumption remains with the defendant until it is overcome by the state with evidence that is sufficient to convince you beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is guilty of the crime or crimes charged. Under our system, it is my duty as the trial judge to determine the law that applies to this case and to instruct you, the jury, on the specific rules of law that you must apply to the facts in arriving at a verdict. I am giving you some of those instructions now, and I will give you more detailed instructions after the evidence has been presented and the lawyers have made their closing arguments. During the trial, I may be called upon to rule on motions or objections to evidence. Nothing I say in making these rulings or at any time during the trial is evidence and should not be considered as an indication that I have any leaning in this case whatsoever. My only interest in this case is to see that it is fairly tried according to the laws and Constitution of the State of Georgia and the Constitution of the United States. As expected, the lawyers serve as advocates for their clients and are duty-bound to represent their clients to the best of their ability. The lawyers also serve as officers of this court and as such are bound to follow applicable laws, trial procedure, and rules of evidence during the trial. If at any time the lawyers believe that any law, procedure, or rule of evidence is being violated, they may make motions regarding the conduct of the trial or objections to the admission of evidence. In making these motions or objections, the lawyers are simply seeking to fulfill their duties to their clients and to the court. Sometimes these motions or objections may require the court to consider outside your presence the questions raised, and you will be excused to the jury room. We will try to minimize the number and length of these interruptions and ask for your patience in this regard. Ladies and gentlemen, trial procedure in a criminal trial is generally as follows. First, the attorneys for both sides have the opportunity to make what is called an opening statement. This opening statement is not evidence. Remember that what the lawyers say is not evidence, but is a preview or an outline of what they expect the evidence to be. Following the opening statements, the evidence will be presented. Evidence can be in the form of testimony given by witnesses or physical evidence that will be labeled with exhibit numbers for identification. After the presentation of all of the evidence, the attorneys have the opportunity to make what is called a closing argument or summation. At this time, the attorneys may suggest which laws are applicable and how they should be considered in light of the evidence and point out to you certain parts of the evidence that they think are favorable to their position. The goal of a closing argument is to persuade you to decide the case in their favor. Following the closing arguments, I will charge you more specifically on the law that applies to this case. I will then ask you to retire to the jury room to deliberate and reach your verdict. The jury has a very important role. It is your duty to determine the facts of the case and to apply the law to those facts. I will instruct you on the laws that apply to this case, but you must determine the facts from the evidence. Evidence, by definition, is the means by which any fact in issue is established or disproved. Evidence consists of two things, testimony and exhibits. Testimony is the testimony that you will hear under oath from those who take the witness stand. Exhibits are those documents, photographs, or other physical evidence that are admitted into evidence. Ladies and gentlemen, the object of this trial is to discover the truth. During the trial, the admission of evidence will be governed by certain rules of evidence. Those rules were drafted with one prominent purpose in mind, and that purpose is the discovery of the truth. Consequently, the rules of evidence seek to assure that only the best and highest evidence is admitted for your consideration. During the trial, the attorneys have a right to object to the admission of evidence if they believe its admission would violate a rule of evidence. I will admit or exclude the evidence according to those rules. If I overrule an objection, this means that you are allowed to consider the evidence being offered. On the other hand, if I sustain an objection, this means you may not consider the evidence being offered. You should consider only that testimony and only those exhibits that are admitted, and you should draw no inferences and make no assumptions about the evidence objected to if the objection was sustained. In the event that you hear or see inadmissible evidence before an objection can be made and ruled upon, if the objection is sustained, I will instruct you to disregard it. And you should disregard that evidence entirely in your deliberations and in arriving at your verdict. You, the jury, must determine the credibility and believability of the witnesses. It is for you to determine which witness or witnesses you believe and which witness or witnesses you will not believe, if there are some whom you do not believe. In determining the credibility or believability of witnesses, you may consider all of the facts and circumstances of the case, the manner in which the witnesses testify, their intelligence, their interest or lack of interest in the case, their means and opportunity for knowing the facts about which they testify, the nature of the facts about which they testify, the probability or improbability of their testimony, and the occurrences about which they testify. You may also consider their personal credibility insofar as it may appear to you from the trial of the case. As the fact finder, it is your duty to believe the witnesses whom you think are most believable. It is for you alone to determine what testimony you will believe and what testimony you will not believe. Ladies and gentlemen, it is important that you pay close attention to the evidence as it is presented during the trial. If at any time you are unable to hear or see any evidence being presented, or if you are suffering from any discomfort that diverts your attention, please feel free to inform me and I will do whatever is necessary to assure that you are able to hear and see the evidence being presented and give it your undivided attention. If you are in need of a recess at any time, please raise your hand and I will recognize you. It is vitally important that you are as comfortable as possible so that you can focus on the evidence being presented. It is important that you view this evidence with an open mind at all times and reach no final conclusions until the trial is over. Do not jump to conclusions before all of the evidence is presented. Also remember that during the course of the trial, it would be improper for you to discuss this case with anyone or to allow anyone to discuss the case with you or in your presence or hearing. This applies even to discussions among yourselves in the jury room or elsewhere before actual deliberations begin. I have asked the bailiff to provide you with pencils and notepads for your use during the trial. You may take notes, but you are not required to do so. If you decide to take notes, please remember that note-taking should not divert you from paying full attention to the evidence and evaluating witness credibility. Your observations of the witnesses during their testimony can be vital to your determination of the believability of their testimony. The notes that you take are for your use only and are not to be shared with anyone until you begin deliberation with your fellow jurors. Notes are not evidence, only memory aids, and should not take precedence over your recollection. It is the duty of each juror to recall the evidence, and while you may consider another juror's notes to refresh your memory, you should rely on your own recollection of the proceedings. Do not be influenced by the notes of other jurors unless their notes help you in determining your own independent recollection. Notes are not entitled to any greater weight than the recollection or impression of each juror as to what the evidence may have been. After the trial is over, the notes will be collected and destroyed. I instruct you, ladies and gentlemen, that you must decide this case for yourself solely on the testimony you hear from the witness stand and the exhibits admitted into evidence. You may not visit any scenes depicted by the evidence. You may not utilize any books or documents not in evidence during your deliberations. You may not read or listen to any accounts of the trial that might appear in the news media. You may not discuss this case with anyone other than your fellow jurors during your deliberations. That concludes my preliminary instructions, and we are now ready for the lawyers to give their opening statements. Before they do that, though, I do need to swear you in as our trial jury. So if you all will please stand and raise your right hands. You shall well and truly try the issue formed upon this bill of indictment between the state of Georgia and Richard Vincent Merritt, who is charged with murder, 2 counts of felony murder, 2 counts of aggravated assault, and possession of a knife during the commission of a felony, and a true verdict give according to the evidence, so help you God. If this is your oath, please state, I will. All right, thank you. Please be seated. Ladies and gentlemen, before the state begins with its opening statement, I do want to bring something to your attention. We do have media coverage of the case going on in the courtroom this week and next week. The cameras are not to be pointed at you. They're here to capture the proceedings and not you, okay? So I don't want you all to be distracted by that or to be concerned about it. So please don't let that distract you from paying full attention to the evidence as it is being presented. And again, as I told you before we got started yesterday, if you are something that you hear or see makes you uncomfortable that you think needs to be brought to my attention, please make sure that you do that as quickly as possible. Speak to one of the deputies and they will let me know that we need to address something. Okay. So, all right. So we are now ready for the state to begin its opening argument. As I told you before, the state has the burden of proof in a criminal case, so the state has the right to speak to you first. Yes.
On February 1st of 2019, the defendant, Richard Merritt, brutally and maliciously attacked and murdered the victim, Shirley Merritt. He used a kitchen knife to stab her multiple times in the back and chest and throat and face. And then he picked up a 35-pound dumbbell, which he held above her head and bludgeoned her with. Then he left her body dead and bleeding and crumpled at the bottom of the stairs to her own basement. Shirley Merritt, the victim, was 77 years old at the time of her death. She was the defendant's very own mother. Now, if Shirley Merritt were alive today, she would have just celebrated her 50th Mother's Day as the defendant's mother. And during the course of this trial, you are going to learn a lot about Shirley. And I think that the theme that you will see is that she was somebody who was always giving of herself. She could have retired years before, but because she loved her job in patient and family services at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, she continued to work there until the day of her death. She was the kind of person that if you were her friend and if it was your birthday, she would have made you one of her famous butt cakes. She loved cooking meals for her family. She loved going to her grandson Jack's games and band concerts. But the person that she probably gave the most to was her youngest son, Richard. Now, the defendant had been an attorney here in the Atlanta area, and it was Shirley who gave him the funds to set up his own practice. On the outside, everything looked fine for the defendant. He was married to his wife, Janine, who was a veterinarian here in town. He had two kids, both of whom were in private school, and he had his own law practice and was in court in Cobb County all the time. But it was discovered that he had violated the trust of his mother, of his wife, of his kids, and of many of his clients. Starting sometime in 2014-15, several of his clients started coming out of the woodwork, reporting that he was stealing from them. Cobb County investigated the charges and found that he had, in fact, stolen hundreds of thousands of dollars and defrauded many of his clients, most of whom were elderly. They charged him with a 34-count indictment with several counts of theft by taking, various degrees of forgery and exploitation of elderly victims. Finally, the defendant was arrested by Cobb County, and it was his mother, Shirley, who put up the money to bail him out of jail. Janine, having learned of this ongoing deception, asked for a divorce, and it was Shirley who opened the door to her home in Stone Mountain for the defendant to have a place to live. Now, as you learned during the course of this trial, Shirley was truly disappointed in her son. She was not pleased with his actions, but still, she was his mother, and she wasn't about to let him sit in jail or live on the street. Finally, on January 18th, 2019, exactly 2 weeks before the day of the murder, the defendant faced a Superior Court judge in Cobb County and entered a guilty plea to all 34 counts on the Cobb County indictment. The judge sentenced him to 15 years to serve. And for some reason, the judge decided to give him 2 weeks before he had to turn himself into the jail. He gave him 2 weeks to get his affairs in order before spending 15 years in the Department of Corrections custody. However, there were some caveats to that. First of all, the defendant had to wear an ankle monitor so that the court system could keep tabs on his whereabouts to prevent him from running. The defendant continued to live in Shirley's house during this period of time. And I'm going to tell you, Shirley was an emotional person, and she was distraught over the fact that her son had been convicted of these charges and over the fact that her son was going to go away for some time. But still, she wasn't going to let him live on the streets for these 2 weeks. Shirley confided in a close family member who's going to testify. He's going to be the first witness the state calls today. His name is Mike Jeffcoat. Mike is a cousin of Shirley's husband. And even though Shirley's husband died several years before the murder, Shirley remained in close contact with him. They were exactly 10 years apart in age, and they just had a really good relationship. Mike Jeffcoat and his wife, Joan, lived in Birmingham. They still do. And Shirley would call him and text him, and you're going to see some of the distress in the text messages that she sent him during this two-week period. Well, knowing that Shirley was going to likely be too emotional to drive her son to the jail, Jeffcoat suggested that he and Joan drive from Birmingham to Stone Mountain the morning of February 1st, which was the turning date, and that Mike would drive the defendant to Cobb County Jail, which is about 45 minutes away to an hour away, while Joan remained at home to keep Shirley company. They were even planning on spending the night because they didn't want Shirley to be alone. None of that ever happened. On the morning of February 1st, Mike Jeffcoat got what he considered to be a very uncharacteristic text message from Shirley. It said, "Mike, I wish you wouldn't come. Please come another weekend. Things are bad here." Mike was worried, but he knew that Shirley was somebody who was emotional, and he wanted to give Shirley and the defendant their privacy on that day. So he and Joan decided not to drive into Atlanta. Well, that text message was the last Mike Jeffcoat or anyone ever heard from Shirley. The next time Mike saw her was the next morning when he drove into Atlanta, went into her house, and found her dead at the bottom of the basement stairs. The defendant, in the meantime, never turned himself in to the Cobb County Jail at 5 o'clock, by 5 o'clock on February 1st. And by this time, he was gone, in the wind. not to be found until a nationwide manhunt uncovered him in Nashville, Tennessee, 8 months later. And we're going to talk about what he did during that period of time, during the course of the trial, and I'm going to get back to that in a few minutes. But let's go back to what happened to Shirley. The medical examiner found that she had been stabbed 4 times in the back, 1 time in the side. She had been stabbed under the right clavicle in the neck, which severed her jugular and caused her to bleed out. She was stabbed several times in the face, and the force was so strong, ladies and gentlemen, that the blade of that 9-inch knife lodged into the bones in her skull and the handle broke off. But that wasn't enough. Because laying next to her, crime scene investigators found a 35-pound dumbbell with blood and hair on the end. And the medical examiner found that the right side of her head had basically been bludgeoned. It had been bashed in to the point where the basal bones in her skull were shattered. Investigators arrived on the scene, and it was very clear to them that this had not been a case where an intruder came into the house and killed Shirley Merritt. There were no open or broken windows. All the doors were closed. There was no sign of forced entry or any tampering at all. All the furniture was upright. There were valuables that had not been stolen. In fact, Shirley Merritt's purse was still on the scene, and it had blank checks. What's more, the two weapons that were used weren't something that somebody had brought in. They came from inside the house. The knife with a 9-inch blade was a kitchen knife that came right out of Shirley Merritt's own knife block on her kitchen counter. The dumbbell was in storage, waiting in her basement, and you're going to actually see the mark on the carpet where it had been resting prior to the defendant picking it up and killing his mother with it. What's more, you know what Shirley had been doing when she was attacked and killed? She was cooking the defendant his last meal before he had turned himself in to the jail that afternoon. Investigators found spaghetti and Shirley's famous bolognese sauce, hot and cooking on the stove, along with a salad that she was about to toss and a loaf of garlic bread that she had just gotten out of the oven with the knife that he used to kill her. Where was the defendant all this time? Well, he went into hiding, but he wasn't hiding under a rock. He drove off out that day, and he went, we don't know where he went, but we know where he ended up. He went to Nashville, Tennessee, and he started a whole new life. He met people out there. He got a job at a bar. He started online dating and, in fact, met a woman who he started a relationship with. But just like his clients, and just like his wife and his kids and his mother, he lied to her as well. Because he lived under an alias the entire time he was out in Tennessee. And you know what? I'm telling you now, it's a ridiculous alias. So ridiculous that I'm not even going to tell you what it is. You'll hear it when the witnesses testify, and you're going to see the fake driver's license that he made with that name on it. He was arrested 8 months later, on September 30th of 2019 by Gerard Hunt and his team with the U.S. Marshal's Office after a nationwide manhunt. You know how they found him? He He was driving Shirley Merritt's Lexus that he had stolen from her garage after he killed her. A few things I want to go over. First of all, something that's really important in this case is the timeline. And investigators were able to put together a very precise timeline. In fact, we know where the defendant was almost every minute of February 1st of 2019, because we have something that we don't have in a lot of homicide cases. As I told you, when the judge in Cobb County gave the defendant 2 weeks to turn himself in, he ordered him to wear an ankle monitor. So we're able to put tabs on the defendant's whereabouts almost the entire day until he cut his monitor off. That morning, the defendant woke up at his mother's house on Planters Row. Excuse me. He left the home at 8 a.m. His daughter, who is disabled, had an appointment with a neurologist, and the defendant agreed to go. It was kind of his last goodbye to his daughter, Mia, and he met his then-wife, now ex-wife, Janine, there. It was a doctor's appointment in Sandy Springs. He returned to the house on Planters Row at 9:38 that morning. Just 1 minute later, Mike Jeffco got, again, what he considered to be a suspicious, uncharacteristic text from Shirley Merritt saying, "Things are real bad here. Don't come." Now, you're going to see the text messages. They are a screenshot. The time on the text message actually says 8:39 a.m., but remember, that was... So he's going to explain to you that he actually did receive that at 8:39 a.m. Birmingham time, but it was actually 9:39 a.m., what would be considered Atlanta time. The defendant leaves the residence, according to the ankle monitor records, at 2:30 p.m. So we know that sometime between 9:38 and 2:30, Shirley started making lunch. She set the table for two, put the pot of bolognese sauce on the stove, cooked the spaghetti, but that meal was never touched because between those times, between 9:38 and 2:30, the defendant was at the house, and sometime during those hours, he killed Shirley Merritt. The defendant leaves the residence at 2:30, and he travels north up to Norcross. He stops at a Kroger just for a couple of minutes, probably to gas up on the way, and he arrives at a QT station in Norcross at 2:52 p.m. Detectives pulled the surveillance camera from that QT station, and you're going to have a chance to watch it during the course of that trial. And you know what's really interesting about that is that the defendant isn't in his own car, which had been left at the scene, and you'll see in photographs. He's driving Shirley Merritt's Lexus. It's kind of a dark gray color, kind of crossover SUV. It will be the second vehicle that you see pull into the QT entryway. You're going to see the defendant get out of the car. He is wearing a green shirt. It has a design on it that says Ecuador. He walks into the service station. He buys a couple of waters, a candy bar, pays cash, and then he leaves. He then travels west on I-285, and he travels north on I-75. At 4:12, the defendant exits I-75 onto the Cass White Road exit. And at 4:14, the ankle monitor company gets the alert that he has cut off his ankle monitor. Steve Queen, who worked with CSRP, which is the security company that was monitoring the ankle monitors at that time, he received the alert immediately. He happened to be up in the Cartersville area. He lived up there, so he called the police. They rushed to that pilot truck stop where the GPS was pinging, but they were 14 minutes too late. They found the ankle monitor. They did not find Richard Merritt. He had cut the ankle monitor with some kind of knife or instrument and thrown it out in a garbage can under a pizza box at a pilot truck stop. At 5 o'clock, the defendant had been ordered to turn himself into the Cobb County Jail, but he never did. He was long gone by then. Well, by this time, Mike Jeffcoat and some other family members had tried to communicate with Shirley. After five, they got a call from the Cobb County Sheriff's Department learning that the defendant never turned himself in, and realizing that they had not heard from Shirley, they got really concerned, so they started calling 911 here in DeKalb County. Officers, Sergeant John Obester and Officer Ashley Nelson from the DeKalb County Police Department went out to Shirley's house, and you know what they found? They didn't find any signs of forced entry. They found that all of the windows were intact. There had been no signs of tampering. The garage door was closed. And let me tell you, they tried to get into that house. They arrived there at 5:39 p.m. and were there for actually a couple of hours. They looked into the windows. They didn't see any kind of signs of struggle. But what they did see is Shirley Merritt's purse just sitting there, which they found to be very strange. They also saw the defendant's car. It was a black Honda, the car that Shirley had bought for him after she posted bond for him, and it was out in the driveway. Well, at this point, everyone was concerned and really worried for Shirley. Mike Jeffcoat made the decision the next morning to wake up early and drive from Birmingham to Georgia. He was able to get a key from the defendant's ex-wife for Shirley's house. He went in, and that's when he saw Shirley laying in the basement. He called 911 on February 2nd at 9:28 a.m., and that's when they arrived and started to investigate. A couple of things that I do want to go over about this case. First of all, we sent some items to the crime lab. We sent three items to the crime lab. One was the handle that had come off the knife that was used to kill Shirley. One was the dumbbell that had been used to bludgeon her in the head. We sent them off for fingerprints and for DNA testing. The results didn't show that the defendant didn't have his hands on his items. They were just inconclusive, which is kind of what was expected because of the materials that these items were made out of. They weren't like fabric, which would be something that would collect and hold on to DNA cells. So they just weren't able to get enough DNA cells off that dumbbell to sufficiently test. And it wasn't like the knife was made out of glass, which is something that would be able to kind of maintain fingerprints. They just weren't able to get anything off of them. Again, the lab technicians are going to explain this to you. They're going to say, listen, this doesn't mean that the defendant hadn't held these items. You're also going to hear that when Shirley Merritt's autopsy was performed, she had a clump of hair in her right hand. We sent those off to the lab as well. They were both microanalyzed, and their DNA was compared. All of the hairs that could be compared to Shirley Merritt's known hair were her known hair. And it makes sense because, as you will see, when she was found, she was crumpled up at the bottom of the stairs with her hands at her head, having been stabbed in the face. Another thing, you're going to see a lot of exhibits here, the testimony of several witnesses. I'm just going to tell you now, the exhibit numbers are not going to be in order, and I am not going to publish every exhibit on this screen. And that is for the privacy and for the sake of Shirley and her family, some of whom are sitting in court today. However, when you go out into deliberations, you will have a chance to see them. Finally, I know you guys, you all are probably sitting here wondering, what is it that I said that made them put me on this jury? And I'm going to tell you right now. It's not a secret. It's not some one thing that you said. You all are here because we questioned you yesterday. You seem like the kind of folks who think using common sense. And that is your greatest asset as a juror. As you listen to the testimony, as you view the exhibit, I am going to ask them that you view them through the lens of common sense, which is what the law is going to ask you to do. And when you do, it's going to be very clear to you that the defendant is guilty of all these crimes. Because the facts of this case are very straightforward. I'm not saying that this is going to be an easy trial. We're going to throw a lot of testimony and a lot of exhibits at you. And you're going to be here listening to several witnesses during the course of the next few days. You're going to hear some hard, heartbreaking things. And you're going to see some ugly, brutal photographs. But it all boils down to common sense. So please keep that in mind as you listen to these witnesses and you view the evidence. Because if you do, I am confident that after reviewing all of the evidence in this case, you will come back with a verdict of guilty to malice murder, a verdict of guilty to both counts of felony murder, a verdict of guilty to both counts of aggravated assault, and finally, a verdict of guilty to possession of a knife during the commission of a crime. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen, the death of Shirley Merritt is a tragedy. Everyone here wishes that we were not here today. Everyone here, including Mr. Merritt, wishes that Shirley Merritt was with us. Everyone here wishes that she did not have her life taken and her fate taken from her. It is a tragedy. You are here with us today to decide the case of the state versus Mr. Merritt. You are here to decide Mr. Merritt's fate, the son of Shirley Merritt. You are going to be presented with evidence and witnesses in this case. You will listen, you will learn, and you will scrutinize all of those things. And I ask that you do so, and I ask that when Mr. Queen gets up here in a few days, stands before you, and asks that you find Mr. Merritt not guilty, that you do so. Because that is what the evidence will show you. And that is what the truth demands. Now, I expect over the next few days that the state will come before you, just as it has today, and focus your attention on the things that they want you to see. They will funnel you the facts that they want to present. They will focus your attention on the narrow time frame at the end of January 2019 and the beginning early days of February 2019. They will do so to try to deflect from the weeks and months before that. They will narrow your attention to the mistakes that Mr. Merritt made, but not the bigger picture surrounding them. And they will present you, as they did today, with numbers. They will narrow you into the numbers to try to deflect from the science and the facts that they do not have. They will focus you on those few days at the end of January and the beginning of February 2019. Those days in which Mr. Merritt was to turn himself in on a sentence, February 1st. The days January 30th and January 31st, when Mr. Jeffcoat, Ms. Shirley Merritt's husband's cousin, was making communications with Mr. Merritt and Mrs. Merritt about the accommodations for them. They will focus you in on those days and not the bigger picture and days leading up to that. They will focus you in on those days and the mistakes of Mr. Merritt, but not what's surrounding it. Let's talk a little bit about the case and the sentence of February 2nd. You will hear that Mr. Merritt was an attorney. And during his time as an attorney, he made mistakes. Mistakes that he is not avoiding. Mistakes that he admitted to. During his time, he took money from his clients. Now what the state will try to distract you from is those individuals a part of that case. That case involved a number of families and people who had money taken from them. It involved individuals who were upset, understandably. They were angry. They had their lives altered, their dreams taken from them, and they were angry. You will hear evidence that they were vocal about it. You will hear evidence, I expect, that it went beyond words, that it went into actions, that it went into fear-inducing and stalking behavior. That is the evidence the state will try to distract you from, but I urge you to look at. They will try to do so by, again, redirecting your attention to Mr. Merritt's mistakes. Mistakes that Mr. Merritt admitted to. Mr. Merritt came before a court and voluntarily pled guilty. He admitted his wrongs, all of them. And he lost his bar license, and he signed up for a lengthy prison sentence. We are not trying to deflect from that. He admitted to that. But the state will try to draw your attention to that, and not the individuals and the circumstances and the atmosphere that Mr. Merritt and his family were going through from that case. They will then try to narrow your attention on the numbers as they have today. They will present you with times of text messages, times of leaving the house or going to appointments. They will present you with coordinates, location coordinates for where people were, or addresses of Mrs. Merritt, addresses of Janine Minicozzi, his ex-wife and their family, addresses where Mr. Merritt was residing when he was trying to survive and when he was trying to stay under the radar. They will present you with these numbers and narrow you in on these numbers because they are trying to distract from the science and the facts that they do not have. Some of you may be familiar with fairy tale, The Emperor's New Clothes. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that this case is similar to that fairy tale, and it is not far from it. In that fairy tale, there are weavers who are going to make clothes for an emperor. And if you know this fairy tale well, you will know they do not make clothes. They are attempting to weave clothes out of nothing. I submit to you that what you will see in this case is that the state is trying to weave a story to you out of nothing. What is this nothing? What will you not have that you need to see? You will have no forensic evidence. There will be no fingerprints on the knife handle that the state presents to you that match Mr. Merritt. There will be no fingerprints of Mr. Merritt on the Dunbar, your representative. There will be no DNA evidence of Mr. Merritt on either of those items. There will be no DNA evidence of Mr. Merritt on Ms. Shirley Merritt. There will be no blood of Mr. Merritt on those items. There will be no blood of Mr. Merritt on his mother. There will be no blood of Mr. Merritt around this scene. You will also hear that Mr. Merritt voluntarily gave his DNA to be considered in this case. But that will not be found. You will have no forensic evidence implicating Mr. Merritt in this murder. You will be presented with no electronic evidence in this case. I expect that you will hear testimony that a number of electronics were collected. Desktops, laptops, cell phones, iPads. There will be no information on any of those tied back to Mr. Merritt in this case. There'll be no incriminating search history, no searches to try to destroy evidence. None of that will be presented to you because it's not there. You will not be presented with any information that Mr. Merritt and his mother had disagreements, fights, arguments, or any kind of ill will. You will hear from a number of family members, but you will not hear that there was an argument between them in the days coming up or the times that they were living together for months. Most importantly, you will not hear any testimony that Mr. Merritt was violent. I anticipate that you're going to hear from his ex-wife. You will not hear that he was violent towards her. You will not hear that he was ever violent towards his children. The state has told you that you will hear from a girlfriend of Mr. Merritt. You will not hear any testimony from her that he was violent. And most importantly, ladies and gentlemen, you will not hear any testimony that he was ever violent with his mother. You will hear none of this in this case, because it doesn't exist. Over the next several days, I ask and urge you to not only look at what is there, but what is not there, what is not presented to you, that Mr. Merritt is not guilty. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor, the state called Michael Jeffcoat.
Are there any witnesses present in the courtroom?
No, Your Honor.
The deputy's going to swear you in.
Okay. I do. My name is Mike Jeffcoat, Jeffcoat.
Good morning, Mr. Jeffcoat.
Good morning.
Where did you start? Where do you live?
I live in Gardendale, Alabama.
Okay. Could you just tell us briefly a little bit about yourself? How old are you?
I'm 71. I am retired and have lived in Alabama every year except one since 1973.
And you said, is that Birmingham, Alabama?
Gardendale is a northern suburb of Birmingham.
Right. And do you live with anyone else in your home?
My wife lives with me.
What is her first name?
Her name is Joan.
Is her last name also Jeffcoat?
No, it's Beck, B-E-C-K.
What was your relationship to the victim, Shirley Merritt?
Shirley was married to my first cousin, Ken. My mother and his father were brother and sister. Ken passed away in 2000, I believe.
Okay. Do you know how long he and Shirley were married?
I don't. I don't remember when they weren't married. And like I said, I'm 71.
And what was the age difference between you and Shirley?
10 years, almost exactly.
I'm going to move this to that. Thank you. Did Shirley have any children?
She had two sons, Richard and Robert.
All right. And are either of them here in the courtroom today?
I see Richard at the defense table.
And what is he wearing? Can you just kind of describe?
He's wearing a suit and tie and the black rimmed glasses right there.
Okay, that doesn't help much. Is he sitting in the middle of the table?
He is.
All right. I'd ask that the record reflect that Mr. Jeffcoat has identified the defendant.
Record shall so reflect.
And is the defendant, Richard, is he the younger or the older of the two children?
He's the younger.
Is the older child in court as well?
He is. I see Rob in the back.
Okay. And what is the age difference? Do you know?
I don't. I just know that Rob is a few years older.
Right. And did you have a good relationship with Shirley?
I did.
Okay. Can you just give a little description of what that relationship was like?
Well, she was married, like I said, to my first cousin, and I have known Shirley for as long as I can remember, and I just always thought she was a very genuinely nice person.
Did she work?
She worked in different capacities as her husband was transferred around the country when they lived in D.C., she was a realtor in the D.C. area, in Northern Virginia, and also worked at here most recently before her death at Children's Hospital.
All right. And do you know what she did with Children's Hospital?
I really don't know.
Right. And did she have any grandchildren?
There were several grandchildren. I think Rob has three or four, and Richard had two.
Do you know about how old Shirley was at the time of her death?
She was 77.
And do you know about where she was living?
She was living on, I think it was Planters Row in Stone Mountain, Georgia.
Do you happen to know what county that is located in?
It's in DeKalb County.
All right. Do you, did you maintain contact with Shirley?
Yes.
And how so? Would you guys talk on the phone, visit? What was that relationship like?
We would talk on the phone. We would text. There were two or three times when I was in Atlanta for extended periods, and I would stay with Shirley for a period of time. Just, we were friends.
All right. Do you recall her phone number?
I've got it in my phone.
Your Honor, I would ask if Mr. Jeffcoat could look at his phone so that he can remember Mrs. Merritt's phone number.
Any objection?
Go ahead, sir. Would you do that, please?
Sure.
You're listening to the trial of Richard Merritt from the Hidden Killers podcast on the True Crime Today Network. Press subscribe now and get ad-free episodes by upgrading to our premium experience through Apple Podcasts. More next.
There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At WashableSofas.com, you'll find the Anabe sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash, perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit WashableSofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at WashableSofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply. Life's messy. We're talking spills, stains, pets, and kids. But with Anabe, you never have to stress about messes again. At WashableSofas.com, discover Anabe Sofas, the only fully machine washable sofas inside and out, starting at just $699. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics, That means fewer stains and more peace of mind. Designed for real life, our sofas feature changeable fabric covers, allowing you to refresh your style anytime. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa effortlessly. Perfect for cozy apartments or spacious homes. Plus, they're earth-friendly and built to last. That's why over 200,000 happy customers have made the switch. Upgrade your space today. Visit washablesofas.com now and bring home a sofa made for life. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply. There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At washablesofas.com, you'll find the Anabe sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash, perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply. There's nothing like sinking into luxury. At washablesofas.com, you'll find the Anabe sofa, which combines ultimate comfort and design at an affordable price. And get this, it's the only sofa that's fully machine washable from top to bottom, starting at only $699. The stain-resistant performance fabric slipcovers and cloud-like frame duvet can go straight into your wash. Perfect for anyone with kids, pets, or anyone who loves an easy-to-clean, spotless sofa. With a modular design and changeable slipcovers, you can customize your sofa to fit any space and style. Whether you need a single chair, love seat, or a luxuriously large sectional, Anabe has you covered. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your home. Right now, you can shop up to 60% off store-wide with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Add a little to your life. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply. Let's be real. Life happens. Kids spill. Pets shed. And accidents are inevitable. Find a sofa that can keep up at washablesofas.com. Starting at just $699, our sofas are fully machine washable inside and out. So you can say goodbye to stains and hello to worry-free living. Made with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics. They're kid-proof, pet-friendly, and built for everyday life. Plus, changeable fabric covers let you refresh your sofa whenever you want. Need flexibility? Our modular design lets you rearrange your sofa anytime to fit your space, whether it's a growing family room or a cozy apartment. Plus, they're earth-friendly and trusted by over 200,000 happy customers. It's time to upgrade to a stress-free, mess-proof sofa. Visit washablesofas.com today and save. That's washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.